It's an absolute honor to be introducing my friend Anjali Bisai. From the introduction, you know that so much can be said about her, from her two-year Indicore fellowship where she was reviving Native crafts with women in Kutch, to anchoring Seva Cafe, a gift economy restaurant in Ahmedabad, to taking a leading role with Gramshri, a sister organization to Manav Sadhana that empowers women and their families through the production of fine household decor, to authoring a top-selling guidebook on Gujarat and an upcoming guidebook on the city of Ahmedabad, to being a pilgrim who's walked the Camino. But I think the place that I really want to start is a few personal stories that showed me some of her character. The first time I remember spending a good chunk of time with Anjali was on a pilgrimage through the villages of Gujarat. And at the end of about a three-day walk, we had reached the town where we had more cell phone reception. And Anjali had gotten a call that somebody from, an elder from one of the families that she had been working with in Kutch had passed away. And I remember Anjali's reaction. You know, she listened to the call, and then she was in tears, and she spent about 5 or 10 minutes in tears. And then I remember her wiping her eyes away and deciding that she wanted to go back and see the family. And I too was sort of at the end of walking for those 3 days, and so I rode back to town to Ahmedabad with her. And I think what I saw in that very brief interaction was just a very strong love that she had for the people around her, but an ability to also make it detached and serviceful. I didn't get the faintest sense that she was going back to grieve or mourn, though that would certainly be there, but it was much more to be a support for the family. And she had that strength very early on. The next thing that was very apparent to me on that ride, that bus ride back to Ahmedabad, was that she was able to be completely present with me despite what was going on with her and with this family that she was very concerned about. She was instantly able to put me at ease and has this gift of being able to do that. We spent the ride reading a book together, where we were co-flipping pages and sort of discussing the book as we went through, because it was an Indian bus that's pretty noisy. And so she has this ability, whether it's young or old, educated or uneducated, to very quickly meet someone where they're at and put them at ease. And that's been a continuing thread through all of the things that she's done. I think another story comes from about a year later, where we were both working on a guidebook together. And Anjali, it was obviously a demanding schedule, but Anjali was also going through a personal experiment where she was trying to test her boundaries. And this took the form of not only keeping up that demanding schedule, but she was actively trying to see how little sleep she could get, how little food she required, and sort of how present and serviceable she could be through all of that. And, you know, most people, when they talk about something like that, there's this element of, like, being kind of maybe wanting a little bit of attention or trying to prove something. But she explained it in such a, you know, I'm probably explaining it in more words than she explained it in. And she just completely was doing it out of a desire to find her own boundaries so that she could give back more. And that's a very rare and beautiful thing. And, of course, another thing that ties all of these things together is her capacity to remain very focused amidst so many distractions. So, and making time for all of the little things that need to be done, including this call. So, Anjali, thanks so much for being here today. I know you have a lot that you could be doing right now.
Thank you, Rahul, and everybody on this phone call. It's actually quite an honor to be introduced by you. So thank you. It's quite an honor to be here right now.
So, Anjali, I think I want the school that you're starting to be the main focus of the call, but before we get there, I kind of want to trace your journey back a little bit. I get the sense that your commitment, or at least your desire to serve, couldn't have started just with Indicor. So I wanted to get your story on where that sort of began and how you got started on this desire to try and give back and connect with others.
Well, I would say that there was never really one incident or one event that really turned me on to service. But my family played a big role. I would say the way my parents brought me up, there was always simplicity and truth. I feel like we're really big core components of my foundation growing up, and maybe community as well. And they were always doing their part in small ways, but always, you know, being part of a bigger community, helping out whenever the need arose. And spirituality was definitely a big part of my upbringing. So I think all of those elements were sort of there. And as I was growing up, I always recognized just how much we had, you know, this opportunity to get an education, to have a supportive family, and to have a home. And I felt like we had those things, me and my siblings, because my parents made the choice to leave India and everything they knew and to sort of do the ultimate sacrifice and come to the U.S. so that they could give us a better life. And so I felt like in some way, if I could pay that forward or pay it, do something to sort of respect that sacrifice, I felt like I wanted to do that. So when I got into college, my freshman year, I had made a decision that at some point, soon after I graduated, I would come back to India and do some sort of community work. And the reason it was India and nowhere else is because I've always felt this really strong connection to India. And so I would say that I can't really share one specific incident, but I feel like those seeds were planted early on in my life, and maybe that's just what came forward when I decided to come to India.
Sure. I think a lot of people in our generation sort of feel that desire to want to connect and give back from the place of all of the gifts and privileges that we've been given. Was there a specific incident that kind of galvanized your desire to stay and to continue serving?
So when I got to India, you know, I was going to be working with women, and it was a women's empowerment project, and I remember being really excited about that and really clueless as to what that meant. You know, I had my own ideas, but I realized that when I got there that, you know, it's a loaded word and you can't really empower anybody. But after I got to Kutch and I was just living there, what I realized is that there was a sense of presence and mindfulness that that I was able to, that was there for me, that I wasn't actively seeking. It was because of the environment and the work and the community. And I realized that it was such a gift because I, you know, I still hear a lot of people who have a good life, but they're still seeking something else and not necessarily content. And, you know, without really even looking for it, it sort of came my way. So I felt like there was something in India and in the work I was doing that I needed to continue exploring and to be part of until I felt like I no longer needed to be. So I really enjoyed my first year in India, and I think 6 months into it, I decided that this was a way of life that I was really inspired by. I was growing a great deal, and just working alongside people, I found it extremely enriching. So I decided to stay on until it was time for me to leave.
So at that 6 month point, was it really a commitment to make this a way of life, or did you say that you would kind of feel out when the time to leave was right and then make a decision at that point?
Actually, at the end of 1 year, I extended it by 6 months. And then at the end of the 6 months, I extended it by another 6 months. And at the end of those 2 years, what I realized I was doing was straddling two places. And I always had an exit option. You know, there was a way out. And it wasn't to say that I needed a way out, but because of that, you know, my mind was in two places. And I don't feel like I was able to give 100% because there was a time limit on it. So at the end of the 2 years, I realized that I wanted to be in India, and I was going to be there completely. So you know, granted I would make trips home and visit my family, but I didn't want this sort of thought in place where I was going to be here for X amount of time and then leave. So I would say at the end of 2 years is when I decided to stay in India permanently, or however permanently one can make a decision about something like that, and then and to really adapt it as a way of life.
Right. So you had, from your formative experiences, I think you, in serving in Kutch, you were in Gandhinugam, which were the villages that Manav Sadhana had reconstructed after the 2001 earthquake, and obviously had a lot of proximity to the Manav Sadhana community and all of the lessons standing on the shoulders of Ishwar Kaka and Jayesh Bhai and Arbind Virenbhai. What were some of the sort of lessons or insights that you were picking up about serving in that early process that took you from that place of you know, the 2 year commitment to a way of life, to, you know, wanting to make it something that was integrated, that you could be fully present for as long as you need to be present for it?
Well, when I first got to India, I was actually a fellow for 1 year, and that too, but when I got to India, we had a one-month orientation program with IndiCorps, and during that time, Arbind and Jayesh Bhai had come to Bombay, and they were speaking to us, and Shruti, another fellow, and I were helping with translations because it was in Gujarati. And I remember thinking, I mean, at that point, my Gujarati was obviously raw, but I remember thinking that even if we can't translate what Arbind and Jayesh Bhai are saying, I felt like everybody there could understand it, because what they were offering wasn't in their words, it was in their presence. And I would say that was probably my first big lesson about service. You know, it was who they were, not what they were doing. And after the orientation, we spent a little bit of time in Ahmedabad with the Manav Sadhana family, and just seeing this sense of community and this interconnectedness and this combination of service and spirituality. I mean, all those things obviously left an impact on me. But our time in Kutch, even though it was an extension of Gramashri and Manav Sadhana, we didn't spend that much time with the Manav Sadhana family in Ahmedabad. It was really the year after I got back to Ahmedabad, when I got back to Ahmedabad, that that was happening. In my time in Kutch, I would say that I learned service maybe isn't my favorite word in the world, but I learned what it means to work with people and to give and to share from the people themselves. You know, there was so much resilience in the way they lived. Just, you know, the Kutch desert is a very harsh climate, and they had managed to strike a balance and make peace with their environment so they could thrive in it. And there's some simple way of living, and a simple way of living in any village, I would imagine, but I feel like I really took away a lot from that. And like I was saying, when I first arrived, you know, I was thinking, okay, there were two of us, so I was like, okay, we're going to empower these women and they're going to stand up for themselves and whatnot. But as soon as we arrived, I mean, these women were up at the crack of dawn. You know, they were working throughout the entire day. They still made time to be able to embroider and to make these beautiful pieces of art that were so integrated with their own identity. And they were amazing mothers and amazing, you know, they took care of each other and their neighbors. And I was thinking that there's really nothing that we can teach them. You know, we're the ones that are going to end up learning in this. And so I would say that was probably my first humbling experience, realizing that really we can't do anything for anybody, but accepting that we're in something together and learning from each other. I felt like, you know, that was something I was able to take forward with me over the course of the last decade.
Yeah, I think when you said you were listening to Jayesh Bhai and Arbind, and you realize that it was who they were and not what they were doing, I think that's really insightful. What was you've done so many things in the process of being in India. How do you decide what you want to do or what you wanted to do next as you were navigating that? And how are you reflecting on that being changing who you were?
I would say that really everything I've had a chance or an opportunity to be part of while I've been in India, it's come to me in some ways. I never felt like I was out looking for it. And because it sort of, I was able to cross paths with every one of those opportunities, of, you know, I guess what was the right time, it always just intuitively felt right. So, like, you know, after I got back, I stayed involved with the Clutch Project for the next 5 years. But I was doing it from Ahmedabad. There were other fellows that came in, and they were working in the field in Kutch. And then, you know, we were working with the community, but sort of getting them to take the leadership. And so when I got back to Ahmedabad, there was conversation about starting the gramashri store and starting a restaurant space next door. And at that time, the idea for Seva Cafe hadn't actually come up yet. And so I was telling Anurban and Jayashree that I would be really interested in helping out with whatever that restaurant space was going to evolve into, and then also being a part of gramashri. So, you know, just naturally, the store idea was actually dropped, and it didn't happen until the following year. But by that time, I was involved in gramashri, and there was peace fair going on and different activities at Manasadna. And that was when I got a chance to really look closer at, you know, the Manasadna philosophy and how Anurban, Jayashree, Virumbai, Vandana Didi, and everybody else, you know, how they practice service and making it sort of their spiritual way of life. And then after that was when the Seva Cafe, the idea for it came up. And so many people, you know, Nipun was around, and John, and Anurban, Jayashree, and I think there were a ton of people. You were around, and there were so many people. And so the idea came up, and there was just this opportunity to be part of it. And so, you know, I can't say I went looking for it. I just happened to be there, and I got very lucky. And it's been the same for almost everything that I've been a part of since.
So gramashri and your work with the women in Kutch also kind of grew into craft roots. Can you tell us a little bit more about what that is?
That craft roots, yeah. So gramashri for the longest time was working with both women in some areas and in rural areas. And most women in rural areas were natural artisans. You know, in the slums, they were getting skill training to have something that they could earn from. But in the villages, it was already part of what they did, and so it was really strengthening them. But they're two very different groups and two very different needs, so over time it made sense to separate the two and to have a specific platform for artisans and a platform from which artisans could develop their skill sets so that they can make it more efficient. There's so much technology today that, you know, it doesn't have to be as tedious as it is. Another challenge that artisans generally face is they don't have the financial resources they need to invest in all the materials to make whatever they're going to sell that year. So by giving them an interest-free loan, either financial or then in materials, it would enable them to focus on developing their work and not worried so much about where is the money going to come from. And then they can pay the loan back after they're able to sell whatever they make. Also having design inputs from other people and getting artisans together so that they can learn from one another and to encourage them, you know, as they strengthen, to pull others from their own community up so that it's a community effort. These were some of the ideas behind Craft Roots, and a way to sort of bring it together was to create this marketing platform where they could all come from different corners of Gujarat and sell what they were making. But more than that, they could really engage with the people that were buying their products. They could demonstrate what they do and how they do it, and so that people could see that, you know, it wasn't just a finished product, but there was so much behind it. And it's really amazing because back in the day when artisans used to make things, they were always engaging with their customers, and so they knew who they were making the products for. They always knew how to improve it. Innovation was organic. And since that divides, you know, since the market lives in the cities, and the producers are in the villages, there's often a divide or a gap. And so this was one way to bridge that gap and to allow that sort of organic communication.
Mm-hmm. And so I imagine...
Sorry, Rahul.
Go ahead.
That was a few years ago. And since then, it's just been amazing how many people have become part of that process, you know, not just from the artisans and the consumers, but you have now institutions and designers and people, you know, and corporations who want to sort of adopt communities. And there's just more awareness overall. And, I mean, that's largely driven by Anurban and a whole team of people, but it's just been an amazing journey to watch over the last 3 years. But go ahead.
And I imagine that the whole thing comes together at the nexus of so many relationships, so many personal relationships that you and so many of the people involved have cultivated over a number of years. How do you, I mean, you do so many things. you know, whether it's the project that you're working on, it's often several projects that you're juggling, and also being there for all of these relationships, whether they're your family relationships or ones that have come through work. I get the sense that you don't make a division between those relationships, but I guess what I'm curious to understand is how you prioritize your time. How do you, I know you mentioned that, you know, the work, it was never something that you sought, but it was just what felt intuitively right in the flow. But everything, every choice that you make is also a choice of not doing something. So I want to understand a little bit more about how you've chosen, how you choose to divide your time in the flow and in the moment.
So when I was a little bit younger, I guess, meaning like, you know, earlier on in this process, I always believed that if something came your you were meant to engage with it, whether someone asked you for something or if an opportunity came. And of course, we have to make choices when there's a lot, you know, but there was a point where I felt like anything that was coming my way, if I could somehow be part of it, if I could contribute something, and if I felt like I was growing in the process, then I would generally engage. But the other side of that is I won't be part of something unless I know I can fully give to it and see it through to whatever point, you know, I can continue contributing my best. But there was a point, obviously, after, you know, as the community in India just keeps growing and it's bigger and bigger and there's so many things going on. And so I did hit this sort of point where I realized that I just can't be giving so much time to so many things. It doesn't make sense for anybody, you know, for the projects or for me or for just for anything or the people involved. So I would say in the last few years, I've really cut down on how much I'm involved with. You know, I'll always be there as a supportive force, but my main priorities in the last few years have become the school and India Guide. We just finished the last book, and that's now done. But I was usually splitting my time between these two things and a little bit of volunteer coordination at Manasatna.
Congratulations on finishing the book. So tell me about how the street school got started.
So I used to live with Anarban and Jeshbe. I lived with them for about 4 years, and en route from Manasatna to their house, there was a community that would come in between, and usually in the evenings I would walk back home. So I passed them almost daily, and they were a community that whenever it rained, there were really heavy rains or flooding in Ahmedabad, we would generally give them some sort of relief through food and clothing and shelter if the rain wasn't stopping. So there was always already a relationship with them. So every time I would pass them up, you know, I would hang out with the kids a little bit, talk to them. And as that continued, you know, I would go home and Jeshwe and I would often have a conversation, and I would tell him I want to do something for these kids, but I'm not sure what. And we would brainstorm ideas, and we both felt that nutrition was important and probably just some value education. And then one day I was walking home, and one of the girls stopped me. Her name was Manisha, and she was about 14 or 15. And she pulled my arm, and she's like, "When are you going to start teaching us?" She's like, "I've never gone to school, and I really want to learn." And she's like, "My parents are talking about getting me married off." And in the community she comes from, the girls are usually married by 16. So I knew what she was saying was true, and I think that when she told me that, I just realized that, you know, there was really nothing to think about. I felt like the very next day I should just go in whatever form or whatever capacity. If she really wants to learn, you know, every child should have a right to be able to learn and to go to school and have a safe and nurturing environment. So she sort of pushed me into going ahead and getting it started. So the next day I had gone back, and I had told Jeshbe, and, you know, he agreed. And so both of us went back to the community the next day, and it also happened to be my birthday that day. And it was funny because, I mean, there was just so many blessings to get it started, because Jeshbe with his magic, you know, we're walking, and this girl's father, Manisha's father, was a complete drunk. And so he stops him, and he's like, you know, "Brother, when are you going to stop drinking?" And then he's like, "Do you know what? You know, your sister over here, it's her birthday, and you have to give her a gift." And, you know, this man is smiling and just, you know, happy in his drunken state. And he turns around, he's like, "Yeah, sure, anything you want." So Jeshbe's like, "She wants you to stop drinking, you know." And so the guy just smiles, and he's like, okay, and he disappears. Like, he gets onto some bike, and he just disappears, and I figured we wouldn't see him. Well, in the meantime, you know, we gather all the kids to tell them that we're going to be starting tomorrow. I'm going to be coming tomorrow, starting the school. And And then Jayshree was like, well, you know, it's Didi's birthday. Let's get ice cream. And so we get ice cream for all the kids. And, you know, all these kids are covered in dirt. I mean, have not showered in I don't know how many days. And, you know, just filthy, but, like, full of just smiles, you know. And the first thing they want to do is offer us bites of their ice cream before they even dive in. And kids who just, you know, they're eating once a day. And so that was sort of the beginning. And then this guy comes back, you know, with his cycle. And he has this single-serving Britannia cake. And it's like a snack-sized cake that you would pick up to, like, nibble on, right, between meals or something. And he's like, okay, for you and from today, I'm going to stop drinking. So we cut this teeny tiny cake up into 20 pieces, you know. All the kids, just like this huge birthday party. And so after that, you know, everybody was out and about, and we told the parents that tomorrow the school's going to start, and everyone's like, okay, great. And that was essentially the beginning of the school. And you know, what pursued for the year was really amazing. I mean, we talked to everybody. There are about 18 houses on the side of the road. And it's the side of the ring road, which is like the busiest loop in Amdava. And so thousands of cars are passing by these families every day. But, you know, in so many ways, they're still invisible. And it's interesting to see how that invisibility affects, you know, their own sense of self and confidence and all the rest of it. But the next day when I arrived, they forgot, like, and they forgot that we were starting school. And so I went to every single house to remind the parents and to gather the children. And the first rule was you had to shower if you wanted to come to school. So the first day, the first 3 days, you know, I went, and every time I would get to someone's house, you know, they obviously wouldn't be showered, so I'd wait and get them cleaned up and then gather them. And it took about 2 hours just to gather the kids. And
wow.
What was funny is that this went on for a year. Every day I would arrive, and the parents would go, today, you know, like school. They're like, oh, okay. The kids wouldn't be seen, you know. And then it got to the point where they would wait. The children would wait to see me coming, and then they would start to shower. And so, but it, you know, it was like a 2-hour process to get them together for four-hour school. And it was also amazing because initially, you know, I thought of it as a side project, just something to make sure these kids were eating properly and had a little bit of, you know, guidance and love in their life. But within the first few months of doing it, I just realized how much potential these children had. They were so resilient and so smart and so full of love that, you know, and I feel like they were able to really express that in their own environment. Their parents were often not really around, and a lot of them were begging and stealing, and that's how they were, you know, the family was eating. And so they just had so many other things to deal with. And so I would say by the end of that year, I had decided to just shift all my focus onto the children and to the school.
Wow. So that was the first year. How many years have you been running the street school?
It's been about 5.5 years.
Wow. And is it the same group of kids that have been involved?
So what happened was the first 2 years, it was the same group of children, minus, you know, the families who come in and out. But they were expanding. Amdavad was expanding the ring road. And so these families were going to get displaced. And so, you know, one of the experiments I had taken up was trying to get the children into, you know, to try to get the families to go back to their villages if they had a village where they had come from. So a few families, you know, agreed, and we were able to get them, you know, somewhere safe. But other than that, like, eventually they either got absorbed into the slum community next door, or then they went to different parts of the city or different parts of, like, neighboring cities. And so to date, I have about 3 families of children that I've been working with over the last 5.5 years. Other than that, there's been a lot of turnaround, at least in the first few years. You know, there were a lot of kids coming in and out because there's a huge difference between street children and slum children. And
what is that difference?
Well, some children have, if you look at it, some children have relatively a lot more security. You know, their families are much more stable. And on the streets, the children are generally raising themselves, even though the parents are around. You never know. If any government figure or politician is passing through, they'll generally demolish the house or confiscate everything. And so every month, usually 1 week out of the month, they don't have any housing. And even when they do have housing, it's, you know, the bare minimums, right? Your plastic and maybe a few, like, metal sheets or something. And so it's a really different game that they're playing. And, you know, it's for them, it really is just about survival. At the end of the day, it's just about getting, you know, through one day and through the next. And so you're just dealing with a lot of other elements. So the children, I was able to absorb a few of them, and then we expanded into the slum community because a lot of the children from the slum were also interested in being part of the school. So. Mm.
Can you talk about how the process of teaching these kids has evolved over the last 5.5 years?
Sure. It's just been a nonstop evolutionary process because, you know, in the beginning, the idea was, okay, just a safer environment, value education, you know, starting with basic hygiene and sanitation. And then more than that, a lot of these children, so there, you know, every household has at least 3 or 4 siblings. And so what you saw a lot of was, like, family rivalry and caste rivalry. So the kids would come together, and they would be extremely protective of their siblings. And so almost every 5 minutes, there was a fight breaking out. You know, there was a lot of this, these just looks that everybody would be shooting each other. You know, they had to bring a bowl for their food. So, like, you know, they would be holding onto their bowl, thinking that if they let it down, somebody's going to steal it. You know, attention span issues, getting them to sit for more than 5 minutes, to engage in games and songs and whatnot. So, like, learning was much further down. You know, it would take a few years to get them into a place where they could absorb any sort of literacy education. But as the process continued, you know, it was amazing to see that the kids started accepting the greater school as their family, started taking care of each other, sharing. You know, there were older siblings who would help take care of the younger siblings of others. You know, not fighting for something, like if we were serving food or if we were giving something. You know, the children would take a step back and let everybody else have it first. I mean, small things, but pretty huge transformations, you know, for children of that age and coming from that background. But as I got a deeper understanding of it and as, you know, as the school was evolving and more kids were joining, I started wondering, you know, literacy education is important, but what I've recognized is that when the need arises, human beings always learn what they need to. So, you know, if you were to ask one of these children to say their multiplication tables, they really wouldn't know what you're talking about, but they know their multiplication tables inside out because they do a lot of the bargaining and the purchasing. All the kids gamble. They can count cards. They know how to divide money. So the skill sets are there because the need had arisen for it, right? So I felt like instead of focusing on literacy education, you know, as my own maybe understanding of my inner growth and spiritual education was increasing, I felt like that's also something that I would be interested in imparting to the kids or encouraging in them because schools are always teaching us subjects and, you know, or basic skills and basic literacy, but I don't, you know, teaching children how to be happy and teaching children how to learn in a situation, you know, how to overcome violence and how to manage their own anger and, you know, how to see sort of the greater community as their family and, to, you know, compassion and empathy and deeper listening and all these sorts of things. So that sort of became the center. I would say that is the center of what we learn today at the school.
So given all of those challenges, has it really been all of these little inspirations of, you know, like the kid sharing his food that have been the fuel that has kept it going, or does it just stem from that deep commitment that you hold? Like, what has really been the thing that's kept you going at this school for 5.5 years?
I feel like, you know, even though it's such a small, it's an extremely small effort. You know, it's a small, we say school, right? But it's a small group of children. It's a small community. But there's so much depth in it. And I feel like, you know, the further and further in I go, the more I realize that there's still so much more to it. And when you're working with children, really the possibilities are infinite. You know what I mean? Like, part of it is planting those seeds, and you just keep planting them. And part of it's also watering it. And then the other part of it is also making sure that the environment is always there for them to be able to grow. And so I feel like it really is. I mean, we teach what we are. You know, and we're not teaching them specific lessons. So I feel like it can go on forever because as I've been doing this, if I'm teaching them something, I try to anchor myself in whatever it is I'm teaching them to make sure that I'm in a place or a space to be able to teach it to them. Mm. So I would say it's probably that combination. I mean, their love and just to see what they're capable of is obviously a really strong force for me, but also how much, you know, I've been transforming in the process. I think, you know, it just keeps me going every day and the commitment and the intention, I think, are probably really strong forces.
One of the things you said really jumped out about human beings always learning what they need to or having a tremendous capacity to learn what they need to when they're in that space. So I guess I want to turn that question back onto you. You touched on sort of the ways in which you've been growing and learning through this process, but can you, how would you encapsulate what you're learning right now and the way you're transforming by doing this school?
You know, in the beginning, I would say, yeah, and obviously by the time I started school, I had had some experience working in communities, and so there's certain things I understood coming into it, but it was still, you know, even if my intention was to be there for the children, there were still expectations, you know, there's still expectations, but I would say that it was probably driven a little bit more by expectations, you know, making sure that children are, you know, they're healthier, they're cleaner, they're happier, they're in a space where they can learn, they're back in school. And so, like, in the beginning, if a child stopped coming, which was common, you know, if you offended them in any way or if they got into a fight with one of the children, they would stop coming for 3 months. I always felt like, okay, you know, what else can I do? Trying to go regular to talk to them and their parents to get them back in. And, you know, feeling the pressures of that, right? Like, it can weigh you down because you're trying. You see these children in really bad situations and they can't do anything about it. But over time, it's been a shift from expectation to intention. And that, you know, it's not so much about transforming the children as it is about transforming myself. So if I can be present and I can be all the things I'm trying to teach them in so many ways, that is probably the most I can give them. You know, and of course we're doing activities and we're learning, and no doubt all the activities are happening, the action's happening. But at the center of it, it's really about me being present and being non-attached to them enough that I can give them what I need to give them without feeling any of the burdens of whether it's you know, if the fruition is there or not. And I mean, I feel like if there's so many lessons I have learned, but the biggest would probably be that, right, which is in many ways the essence of the Gita, and that you do what you can do, the best that you can do it, and you do it as an offering without expecting anything. And it's easy to say that, but they've really taught me, because what I've seen in the last few months and few years is that it's become really effortless in some ways. And a lot of that has to do with, you know, having been with some of these kids for so long, they're now really strong in who they are, that they anchor the school. And, you know, there used to be a time in the beginning, if a new child came in, that was all it took to throw 20 kids, you know, into madness. And recently we did an experiment where every child had to bring one new child into school. And we had talked about finding the child who could probably benefit the most. So, you know, children who had dropped out of school, kids who were into serious gambling, stealing, you know, just getting into trouble. So they all went out, got a buddy, and brought them back to school. So one day I had the initial 25 and then 20 new children. And I really didn't know what to expect. And as soon as they all came in, I mean, it was perfect for like 3 hours. There was nothing, no chaos, no fighting, nothing. All the kids were listening. And I feel like a big part of that was, you know, part of it was because of the children and their own strengths, and part of it was also because of, you know, being able to move from expectation to intention.
Okay. Wow, that's beautiful. Anjali, I know that there's a lot of people who want to ask some questions, and I think Kanchan can switch over to the to open the queue for those questions.
Yes.
But I wanted to ask you one more question as we lead into the open Q&A, where others are able to ask. But, you know, I know that a lot of people who are in our communities, specifically the service-based community and Manasadhana communities, look to find a way to combine their sort of their service and their spiritual growth and also living, you know, surviving, making their way in the world. And you seem to have done that. I mean, you use the word with the school, you know, you use the word effortlessly, but there seems to be this effortless way in which you've combined these three things of, you know, inner growth, outer service, for lack of a better word, and sort of livelihood, if you will. What have been your sort of insights on walking the edge between, or the intersection between those three strands?
Well, I would say that I've been really fortunate to have been able to find a balance for all three. and to take them up in ways that they all resonate. So for me, there's no division between the school and my inner transformation and my livelihood. Of course, they require different things and you're put into different situations, but I feel like there's an alignment for me in all three of those things, so they don't conflict in any way. And because there's an overlap, you know, the livelihood is obviously a separate thing from the school and from my transformation, but there's an overlap, and who I am is maybe similar in all three of those spaces. It is also maybe not so much of an effort to balance it. And it is a struggle, I think, but for me, I won't do something unless I really intuitively feel like it really does resonate with me. So if it does and I take it on, then there's really no questioning it, and everything that comes, good or bad, is part of the process, so it's always always welcomed, right? It's there to sort of polish me. And so I don't know if that answers the question, Rahul, but I just feel like that would be it, if I've been able to find an alignment within myself and to bring all three of those and to balance them. And I'm always learning from, you know, what I'm earning from and also from the children. So there's no sense of exhaustion or burdening myself or, you know what I mean? It's really genuinely, I'm just grateful for it, I guess. But
yeah, beautiful. I think I understand. Gunjan, do you want to turn things over to the folks in the queue?
Yeah. Thank you so much, both of you. This was such a wonderful conversation to listen to. And I'm sure lots of people have questions. So the Q&A queue is on. And maybe I'll start it off with a question, Anjali. Peter and I have been mentoring, quote-unquote, four refugee kids here in Portland. And they are siblings, and they live in the same house. And we go, and it's like a program where we go once a week, and there is no set format. It's kind of free-flowing, and we can teach them. It's basically to help them get integrated in the society here. And what you just said resonated so much with me when you said that it's not that they can't do multiplication tables, yes, but they can count the gambling and all that stuff. And the same thing I observed here is they hardly speak English and they struggle with even reading or writing simple words, but they are all on Facebook and they are able to, you know, I don't know how they do it, but they post pictures and they are on Facebook. So it sometimes makes me sad that, you know, I go into this negative mode thinking that, oh, what's going on in the world and why are the priorities shifting like that? But it's the reality, and maybe they have to go through that process. And I'm just curious to know how you kind of, you know, how you dealt with this situation when you noticed this whole thing about they can't do multiplication, but they are good with gambling, and how can you switch it around and kind of, or just be patient and wait and see what evolves, or do I tell them that don't spend so much time on Facebook, or I'm just curious, like, how would you deal with such a situation?
So things like this come up all the time, and obviously in the community where I work, gambling is the key issue, and there's a lot of alcoholism, truancy, children drop out of school to go to work, and just a lot of violence as well. But Thich Nhat Hanh uses the term Dhamma Rain, which I really like, and that's that you know, like when he says, when you're reading what I've written, if you don't understand it, it's okay, but accept it, that it's rain, and just let it soak in, and when the time is right, you'll understand it. And I think it's the same with children. I think that when you lecture children, not lecture, but like, you know, obviously, it took me a long time to understand how to discipline without necessarily imposing something on a child. And so, you know, often I have an issue, for example, with a lot of these item number songs that come out in India where women are gyrating, and I just can't understand it. And that's what the kids love to dance to. So I'll have an open conversation with them and say, hey, you know, I don't agree with this, and these are the reasons why. Tell me, you know, why you think it's a good thing. And we'll keep having the conversation. You know, a lot of times they'll just be like, oh, whatever, Didi, you know, or whatever. But a lot of times they'll give me reasons, and then we'll talk about their reasons. And so it's an ongoing conversation. Yeah. And I think for me what's more important isn't that they stop what they're doing, but that they, if they can justify it to themselves, then, you know, that's okay, right? They should understand why they're doing something versus doing it for the sake of it. And so I don't know, like when a situation like that comes up, it's usually how we'll deal with it. It's just a lot of sharing and talking and trusting, I think, is the other big part of it. Like, they're going to they have to go through phases. You know, they say a child, when they're 6 or 7, they learn about violence, and that's when you'll see a lot of children killing bugs. and doing different things, and they sort of have to be able to pass through that stage to eventually, you know, make a decision whether they want to live that way or if they want to choose a more nonviolent way of living. So I think it's like all of us. We've gone through those phases in our lives in various forms.
Thank you so much.
Hi, Anjali. Namaste to you for living your Indian dream. It's just wonderful listening to you and your experiences and insights. Thank you so much. My question was, what is your perception on what is the mindset of the woman that could pack in so much in a single day, the woman of Kutch I'm referring to, and what do men contribute, like how do they contribute? So I just wanted to know. Thank you.
Well, you know, it's obviously it's a different, the roles are different of life in Kutch and the social norms, and so there's a contribution, there's a partnership for sure. And I would say that you could probably see the separate feminine and male qualities in Kutch maybe more than you can, you know, in Ahmedabad and then of course in Houston or somewhere in the U.S. There are times where as a woman, especially someone born in the West, I would get extremely frustrated with what I thought was, you know, this huge gender gap or disparity. But like with everything else, as you know, you as I was observing and understanding, there are things that need to change, and they will change with time. But what you know, when the women are working all day long and the men are not, from one perspective, it's like, okay, this is really unfair. All of the burden is on the women. But when you talk to the women, there's so much pride in how they raise their families and how they take care of them, and it's a big part of who they are. And you don't. I didn't sense any sort of inequality in what they were saying or a lack of justice or righteousness or you know. So the balance is there, but I would say it's not necessarily always extremely visual or observable. And, you know, on the superficial level, I think there's lots of changes we need in the world. But it also depends on how a person sees it and sees themselves in that situation. And I would say in that sense, the women in Kutch are perfectly... they're strong, and they love who they are and what they do. So.
Okay. Thank you.
Hi, Anjali. This is Pallavi calling from San Jose. And first, I'd like to thank you because, you know, there's a beauty about you that has come across on this call. It's, you know, there's a quietness to you, and there is a serenity, and it's really... beautiful. And my question probably, you know, is in the same direction, which is in the beginning of the call, you talked about the word empowerment, and you said something really interesting, which was you can't really empower someone else. So I wanted to kind of ask you to go deeper into that, because I'm sensing that there's a lot of subtleties in there that you have probably realized or recognized. So could you talk more about that, please?
Sure. Thank you. So basically, you know, when we use the term empowerment, and it can mean so many different things, but empowerment usually means that you're enabling somebody to do something. And somehow I feel like empowerment refers to something external, like an external process. But everything we need in life is inside of us.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like, you know, what we can do for one another is support each other, to guide each other, to love each other, and to give tools, you know, especially to children. You know, give them options, give them tools, give them exposure. But the rest of it, you know, whether it's a woman or a child or an elderly or a man or an animal, I mean, like at the end of the day, it's about them choosing to take forward what they have inside and seeking it. And, you know, like, for example, the children that I work with, they're not in a space where a lot of that can be nurtured. So I would say that, you know, if the Patang Youth School does anything, it's probably that. It's just nurturing what they already have inside of them. And, you know, but it's not one person nurturing it for somebody else. It can only happen if it's a partnership, if that makes sense. And so I just feel like when we think that we can empower anybody, you know, I really feel like all we can do is encourage somebody to look inside and to be there for them as they go through that and they pull out what they find and work through whatever's coming up and then sort of finding themselves, you know.
So may I also turn this around and ask you what empowers you?
So I would, everything I have, I don't know, everything I've been a part of, but right now I would definitely say that these children inspire me. I wouldn't necessarily empower me, but they inspire me because, you know, I often, when I look at them, I see me, and I know that the day I walked in with, you know, a chip on my shoulder, a thought in my mind, I can see it, you know, transforming into the classroom. And so they inspire me on a daily basis to be a better person and to be all the things that, you know, I encourage them to be. Mm. And they're also, they give me so much hope because despite the situation they're in, they have so much resilience, so much love, and so much forgiveness and compassion and empathy. And I just feel like, you know, so I don't know if they empower me, but they absolutely inspire me.
Okay, thank you. That was beautiful.
Thank you.
Thank you. Hi, Anjali. This is Vinya. Thank you so much for this beautiful call. My question was, what is your daily spiritual practice, and how do you, you know, I'm sure now it comes effortlessly to you, but in the beginning stages of being a man of sadhana, how did you prioritize what you wanted to do then? Because there's so many beautiful things happening there. Thank you.
Thank you. So the daily schedule, I would say my mornings are pretty set, and then everything else is generally open. But I usually start my morning, if I'm running, then I'll go run. It's been on and off, but otherwise I'll do yoga and meditation. Meditation is the key part of my day. I'll make sure that no matter what, I get it in. So I sit in meditation, and then I'll clean my house, I'll read a little bit, I'll have breakfast, and then the day starts. And, you know, it could range from working on the book or doing some research or going to Manav Sadhana than being in the school. Even though I'm working with children, I'm working also with their families. And so there are a lot of things that come up, whether it's having to go to the doctor or helping somebody with, you know, livelihood or something of that sort. So that also takes up a lot of the day. And then in the evenings, I try to do a little bit of writing or reflection. And that's usually the general course of my day. And in terms of prioritizing, it's really just about whatever I've committed to for that day in the short term. And but, you know, I've also learned, this is a lesson I've learned from Deshbe and Manav Sadhana, and that's that whatever comes your way, whoever happens to be there at that moment, it's really important also that you don't just push them to the side because you've made a commitment. So being open and sort of working with whatever comes your way that day is really, really important. So, you know, if there's a festival going on and I've committed myself to work, I'm going to go do the work. But if I've committed myself to work that doesn't involve another human being and somebody shows up, I'll probably put them first.
Wow. Thank you.
Thank you. I hope that answered the question.
Yes, you did.
Hi, Anjali. This is Ian Desai. I'm one of those people who Anjali, whose work fell in front of Anjali, and she kind of rolled up her sleeves and just started helping. And I still remain grateful to this day. And it's been wonderful to listen to everything you've said so far. I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about you would probably call it just a walk, your walk in Spain. It sounds like it was more than just a walk, but if you could tell us about that experience, the silence element of it, what you learned and gave to it, took from it. And I guess the other thing is, you know, this is a global service community that has this specific link to India and, you know, has a lot of energy routed through things that have been going on at Manav Sadhana. And I was just thinking if you could meditate on what, you know, what it means to be part of this global service community that has, you know, this kind of spiritual presence in India, but, you know, obviously has people who are all over the world, particularly in the United States and North America, who are kind of heavily invested in this. And then when you took these experiences to Spain as well, you know, kind of, do you see yourself really still living, you know, kind of fully in India with connections to America, or you now kind of, as the Spain trip kind of opened up, you know, kind of worldwide system for you? Thanks.
Thanks, Ian. Hi. So the walk, the pilgrimage, the walk was really amazing. It came at the perfect time. You know, I just feel like I was in a place where I could really take as much as I could from that walk. And I came away with a lot, but, you know, one was just I really understood the power of faith and patience. And also this idea that I feel like, you know, we're always trying to build in our lives, whether we're building community or we're building ourselves or we're networking or building our skill sets or whatever it is. In some way, even if it's with the greatest intention, we're still building. And I think while I was walking, I just realized the importance of letting go, and that if you really want to get down to the truth of it all, if you really want to understand yourself, you have to just let go of everything. And so that sounds, you know, when we use words like presence and being and letting go, it doesn't mean not doing anything because we're part of this world, but internally, just really letting go, you know, and not really looking to create anything, but to find what's deeply, deeply rooted inside of us. And I think being in nature and walking really, really brought that to the fore. Because the other thing, which I just encourage anybody who's never done a long walk, wherever it is, like walk for more than 5 days, you know, or a week. And something really magical, really, just begins to happen because you're organically, effortlessly just letting go of things. And even if you're consciously trying to understand something, you just, there's like no effort. It's just it's happening at its own pace. And so the knowledge and the wisdom that you're understanding, it's much deeper. And I think it's much more connected to you. And then being in the middle of nature, you know, there's so many lessons to be taken away from that, including like our own true nature. So I would say that I learned so much, and it's hard for me to summarize it into just a few sentences, but it's just really, really a power. It was a powerful walk, and I'm really grateful that I was able to do it. And as far as the global service community goes, I was just thinking this morning that how amazing and just inspiring it is to be part of this humongous family where everyone is somehow doing something amazing in, you know, whatever space they're in, and that, you know, so many people I've met, so many I haven't, and so many I probably never will, and yet we're all still connected. And just knowing that is a really, like, it's just a super force. You know, and so I'm extremely grateful to be part of something like that. And that interconnectedness, I think, is just, like, I don't know, a little bit of you is in me, right, Ian? And so when you're doing something, you know, it's uplifting all of us in some way. And in terms of countries and states and borders and all that good stuff, I don't really know. I don't know where I'll end up. You know, I promised myself the day it makes sense for me to leave, I will. And, you know, as I travel more and just whatever you do, realize that it's not really about where you are. And you just have to take who you are with you wherever you go. So it's hard. It's still difficult. But I think it becomes easier and easier, and it's not really about where I am or where I'm going to be for the rest of my life.
Hi, Anjali. This is Audrey. It's really great to hear all your reflections on this call. And my question was kind of general. I was wondering, in the years that you spent in Lama Sadhana and gone through, and just in Ahmedabad in general, are there any kind of, I mean, I'm sure there's a lot of lessons you've learned and a lot of ways you've changed, but are there any, I guess, how have you changed in all that time, like from when you went there as an Indicor fellow to now?
I would say that there's like two things. There's many, many things, but just maybe two major things would be. One is stillness. I feel like I've just become a lot more still from within, and that gives me a great sense of inner confidence. There's a word in Gujarati that people translate into self-confidence, which is Atma Vishwas, but it really means Vishwas is trust or faith, and Atma is your soul. And so it's like just having complete trust or faith in your soul or in who you are. And it goes well beyond self-confidence, right? So there's this inner strength. And so I feel like that's really developed. And that allows me to be still from within no matter what's going on. And there's a lot more I need to learn and practice in that itself. But I feel like at least I've been able to enter in some way into that stillness. And the other thing I would say is probably faith. Really trusting and having a great deal of faith in what happens in life, you know, with with the universe or the Almighty or whatever you want to call it, but really just having a great deal of faith in that and knowing that, like, everything is impermanent, everything will be fine, and everything is good. I feel like those are probably two questions I've really taken away.
Thank you.
Thank you. These are really good questions, everybody.
Yeah. Anjali, I had another question. This is actually two quick questions. This is Vinya. I wanted to know, how do you manage your, you know, financially, how do you support yourself? And the other thing I wanted to know is, what do you do about self-care? You did mention meditation, which is the best thing we could do, but still, are there other mindful things you do? Because you can get so swept away when, you know, you're running with parents and children and doing all the million things, just eating your food on time, even that can be a challenge. So what are your thoughts on those things?
So in terms of, oh, actually, sorry, Vinny, what was the first question? Oh, sorry.
Oh, I'm sorry. My first one was about money and, like, how do you support yourself?
When I first got to India, the first 2 years, I had saved up in college. So as a fellow, you're living really simply, and they give you a stipend and an India course. So that's what I was surviving off of, and then whatever I had saved. And then I decided to stay on in India longer, you know, I decided I would only do it if I could also be financially independent. And so I worked for a short while. I have a background in journalism, so I worked for a short while in a magazine, and I was earning from that. And then a good friend of mine and I decided to start a small company to write guidebooks that Rahul was also part of. And so for the last 5 years, on and off, I've been able to support myself from that. And, of course, that goes hand in hand with also living simply. But it's been enough for me to be able to support myself financially. And also, I enjoy it, so it's been really nice. And in terms of self-care, meditation, I think, does do a big part of it for me. But also small things, like I like to clean my apartment. So just sort of being in that space and cleaning, it really just calms me down and I enjoy it. And cooking and reading are probably the main things, and yoga and running are usually what I do to just...
Are you able to eat your meals on time because you're out so much?
Oh, no, I'm horrible with the eating on time. Really, really bad. But what is absolutely amazing is in the school, I haven't really spoken much about the children, but there's a kid named Rahul who's 19 now. And, you know, I've been in the U.S. for 6 weeks now. And he is – the whole idea behind the school was really, you know, to encourage leadership and sort of self-reliance and, you know, community and family. And so he is the assistant teacher. And, you know, he runs it when I'm not there, and he takes care of all the kids. And so his family has become my family in a lot of ways. And so if I'm ever there and it's anywhere near a mealtime, his mom, without telling me, will always include in the meal. And it's amazing. So I'm always eating. If I'm at the school and if I'm there all day, I'm fed my meals. They take care of me.
Hello, Anjali. My name is Ilyas. I live in the Bay Area in Oakland. And quite a few years ago, actually, I saw a beautiful little video clip of your work with Seva Cafe. And I want to say that was almost 10 years ago, I think, but I can't quite recall. And I was incredibly inspired. And that was the first time I ever heard the expression, think globally and act locally, that you had stated. And it was incredibly inspiring. And so I was really pleasantly surprised when I saw your name pop up after all of these years. And then it occurred to me that, of course, you would be a part of this amazing community, the service-based community and the Manav Sadhana community. So thank you for an incredible and inspiring sharing. My question is, do you find, or what is it about India? In my experience of being in India, I found that if someone wanted to do something, some form of service, it seemed to be much easier. Of course, there's a need everywhere in the world for all manner of things. But I found that in India, if I wanted to do something, if I wanted to serve somewhere, it seemed to be much easier. And in fact, starting projects was much easier than, let's say, here in the States. where perhaps there is more red tape. If you really want to make a significant inroads into a community, do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, so I think a lot of people come into India and, you know, often want to start something, and I think that there's always opportunity, but I also think starting something is really, unless there's a real need for it from wherever, you know, if it's within a community, if that community, if something's stated by the community and it's started, it makes sense, you know. It is a different time in India. It's a creative time right now. Anything is possible, whether it's, you know, on the service side or development or even business and enterprise-wise. But it's easier because people are more open. There's a lot more opportunity. But I also feel like there's a great deal of responsibility to make sure that it is indeed necessary for the people that are involved.
Yes.
Thank you, Anjali. I was just going to ask you on behalf of the community service base what we can do to support you.
I would say that whoever would like to come and spend time with the kids and teach, you know, whatever they're passionate about, that would be the best way to help. And just all your good wishes, it really makes a difference. Outside of that, there's really nothing. I hope that at some point all of you guys can make it out to Ahmedabad and spend some time with the children.
Thank you so much, Vinya. Did you have something?
Yeah, I do. I just wanted to do a really quick closing of gratitude. So, you know, when we think about Manav Sadhana is like this, you know, and Gandhi Ashram, and all the beautiful things that happen there. It's like this beautiful oak tree, and it gives so much of support and groundedness and inspiration and strength to all of us. And we have so many lessons to learn from it. And Anjali, today's call with you and your presence was, you know, like this, like the mothership. Just you were just with your presence and with all the beautiful and honest reflections that you shared, you have given all of us such incredible insight into what it could be to, you know, to lead a life like yours, to those of us who seriously would like to do that and who are striving towards it. So thank you so much for your precious time and for all your incredible and honest words of wisdom. It really meant a lot to all of us to be with you today.
Thank you, and really, really thank you for giving me this opportunity, because I actually have never, I've never shared so much about the school in one go, so I really wasn't sure what was going to come out, to be honest, so it was a lovely experience for me, too.
Thank you so much, Anjali.